Richard Strauss is a hard man to pin down. As an artist, he was never tied to a single style.
He was a very facile composer. I mean, he could write with an ease that's incredible.
Some of his tone poems, just the sound of them, were quite shocking.
Sometimes we read of the soprano riding the orchestra, kind of surfing the wave of the orchestra.
Richard Strauss embraced many musical forms during his lifetime. There was only one guiding principle, his artistic compass, that music is a holy art. He set those very words to music in his opera, Ariadne of Naxos. For Strauss, this was far more than a line in a libretto. It was a way of life. In this next hour, we'll explore Strauss's dedication to his art, his grand orchestral works, and his unforgettable operas. I'm soprano Debbie Voigt. Welcome to Music is a Holy Art, a Richard Strauss celebration from WQXR in New York. Richard Strauss lived to the ripe old age of 85. Here's music writer Paul Thomason, who has written extensively about Strauss.
It's interesting when you think about Strauss's life, the astonishing span of it. He was born in 1864, so Abraham Lincoln was president, and he died in 1949, Harry Truman was president. From the American Civil War to right before the Korean War.
Born in an era of oil lamps, dies in an era of nuclear reactors. That is pretty incredible.
That's Brian Gilliam, one of the world's great Strauss scholars and author of many books and articles on Strauss. He teaches at Duke University in Durham, North Carolina. Strauss was born into a musical family in Munich. His father, Franz Strauss, was the most famous horn player in Europe and the principal horn in the Munich Court Opera. Back to Paul Thomason.
The story goes that when Strauss was a toddler, when he heard a violin playing, he cried. When he heard a horn playing, he got very excited.
There's an interesting issue about the father of Richard Strauss.
That's Leon Botstein, music director of the American Symphony Orchestra and president of Bard College.
Clearly a fantastically influential man, whose legacy probably is in his son's attachment to the French horn. So from the father, he gets the love of the French horn. And nobody has written music as well for this instrument as Richard Strauss.
Strauss was a prodigy, and his father knew it. He got him piano lessons, theory lessons, and violin lessons at a young age. Strauss wrote his first piece at age 6, called the Schneider Polka. His mother's family was quite wealthy. They owned a beer brewing company. They were also music lovers, and every weekend the extended family would get together in a big townhouse in downtown Munich and play. Here's Brian Gilliam.
And so he composed chamber music, piano pieces, songs that would be performed in these Sunday matinees.
In addition, his father conducted a community orchestra on the side, and so Strauss could test out his orchestral compositions as soon as he wrote them. Strauss's first piece to gain attention was his Opus 7 Wind Serenade, which he wrote as a teenager. He also started composing for the voice. That's Zweignung from his Opus 10, which would become world famous. Here's another well-known one, Alle Seelen. And of special note is his first horn concerto, written for his father. Strauss Strauss's father was very controlling in what he allowed his son to consume musically. He gave him a steady diet of the classics, Mozart, Haydn, and Beethoven. Although Strauss's father had played in the world premieres of several Wagner operas, he absolutely loathed Wagner and forbade his son from playing Wagner's music. More from Brian Gilliam.
There's a famous incident, you know, where he had the score to Tristan hidden under his bed, kind of like a Playboy magazine or something. And his father was practicing in the next room, and Strauss could not resist but try out a few chords of Tristan on the piano. And the father rushes into Strauss's room and says, "What's this? What madness? What are you getting yourself into?" And scolded him up and down.
Despite this, Strauss got hooked on Wagner and would eventually be enormously influenced by Wagner's harmonic language. One of the earliest examples of this is the tone poem Don Juan, which Strauss wrote at the age of 24. Let's take a look at it. So what's going on here?
We have an opening theme that shoots up, gosh, in two measures, a couple of octaves or more. I mean, it doesn't take a Sigmund Freud to figure out this vaulting melody and what it means in its erotic profile. So we have this vaulting, energetic melody, which gives us the immediate picture, this man with a huge libido and seemingly inexhaustible sexual desire.
Eventually, we witness Don Juan meeting his first lover. He is enchanted. She is a high-strung lady.
It's high-strung, literally. It's in the violins. It's a very chromatic melody, full of passion.
Strauss frequently used solo violin to portray a woman, but it is the overflowing orchestra sound that would become his signature style.
The Germans call it Wohlklang, and I don't know, it's not really a good translation for that. It's a burnished, highly polished, lush sound. You just are sitting in a bath of sonic splendor.
There are many versions of the Don Juan story. Strauss used the one by Nikolaus Lenau as the basis for his tone poem, and he included the following quote in his published score.
"My friend, would that I could fly through every place where beauty blossoms, fall on my knees before each one, and were it but for a moment, conquer."
And conquer he does.
He's irresistible, and they fall for him every time, and that's the way the story works. In this Don Juan, he's always ready for more.
And so we move on to lover number two. This time, the woman is portrayed by the oboe.
It's a very sweet, lovely tune, suggesting not so much a high-strung woman, but a more poetic, serene, reflective woman.
The French horn was Strauss's favorite instrument, and he uses the horns to represent Don Juan himself. Here's Alan Gilbert, conductor of the New York Philharmonic.
I've always thought of that as a very masculine theme. Somehow it's a, hey, look at this moment, and this kind of strutting sense. It's so proud and so, in a way, vain.
After vividly portraying Don Juan in music, Strauss turned to something far more serious, death and transfiguration. Back to Brian Gilliam.
It is the most serious of all his tone poems. Even the ones that have a serious topic usually have some kind of humor in them at some point. Don Juan is erotics and humor. And one wonders, again, he was around 25, 26, a young man who had no major illnesses, is contemplating what it feels like to die.
This time Strauss makes up the story himself. Here are Strauss's words.
"It was 6 years ago that it occurred to me to present in the form of a tone poem the dying hours of a man who had striven toward the highest idealistic aims, maybe indeed those of an artist,
in the time of the tone poems, they're all artist heroes, these protagonists. So this artist hero is dying. We have this wonderfully cinematic opening scene.
The sick man lies in bed asleep with heavy, irregular breathing. Friendly dreams conjure a smile on the features of the deeply suffering man. He wakes up. He is once more racked with horrible agonies. His limbs shake with fever. As the attack passes and the pains leave off, his thoughts wander through his past life. His childhood passes before him, the time of his youth, with its strivings and passions.
You got to remember, of course, that Strauss is a lifelong atheist. So his whole view is that we don't go to heaven, there is no God, but we are transformed. Our end is our art. We end in our ideal.
As our artist hero gets closer to death, he glimpses his own ideal. And Strauss gives the ideal a musical theme. Here's what the ideal sounds like.
As the pains already begin to return, there appears to him the fruit of his life's path, the conception, the ideal which he has sought to realize, to present artistically, but which he has not been able to complete, since it is not for man to be able to accomplish such things.
Our artist hero is running out of time.
The hour of death approaches.
And with the striking of the gong, he's dead.
The soul leaves the body in order to find gloriously achieved in everlasting space those things which could not be fulfilled here below.
At this point, the piece has shifted to something new.
It begins in C minor, it ends in C major. It is transfigured, transformed from the minor to the major. And that is a musical convention that has a very powerful narrative implication. And this ideal theme comes back in fragments, kind of a build-up. And then we have this final presentation. For the first time, the full orchestral presentation of the ideal in C major. The idea of transformation, transfiguration, was a lifelong thing for Strauss.
After Death and Transfiguration, Strauss tried his hand at writing opera, his first. It was called Guntram, named after its title character. Strauss wrote the libretto himself, creating the name Guntram by combining two characters from Wagner operas, Gunther in Götterdämmerung and Wolfram in Tannhäuser. More importantly, he wrote the lead female role Freihild for his future wife Pauline, who sang the premiere. He proposed to her during the rehearsals. Unfortunately, the opera was not a success, and Strauss took it very badly. He went back to writing tone poems, and this time, something far more lighthearted.
Once upon a time, there was a knavish fool named Till Eulenspiegel.
Originally, Strauss was planning to make an opera out of Till Eulenspiegel, the infamous German folklore prankster, but ultimately decided a tone poem worked better with the subject matter.
What he wanted to do, basically, was to have a tone poem about a character who makes fun of and tricks a very narrow-minded community.
And so Strauss wrote his most humorous tone poem, the complete title of which is Till Eulenspiegel's Gleeful Exploits After an Old Rogue's Tale Set in Rondo Form for Large Orchestra, Opus 28.
It's not really a complete story. They're just little sonic pictures.
There are many versions of the folk tales, but Strauss makes up his own. In his version of the story, Till plays a series of pranks on the citizens of a town called Schilda, and sonically they are quite graphic. Here's Michael Tilson Thomas, conductor of the San Francisco Symphony and the New World Symphony in Miami.
Some of the very wry episodes that occur along the way, the barking of dogs as Till tries to storm his way into a gated enclosure. Moment when he, on the roof, decides to relieve himself onto his tormentors below, which is very perfectly represented by the violin solo, the glissando. That's what that's supposed to represent.
And what did Strauss write next? Something completely different. Also sprach Zarathustra, which translates as Thus Spoke Zarathustra, is the most recognizable piece Strauss wrote. Here's New York Philharmonic conductor Alan Gilbert.
It's an amazing work that, of course, has this iconic beginning that is unforgettable and probably unmatched in any music before or since in terms of orchestral sonic glory.
You probably know this music from the movie 2001, A Space Odyssey, but here it is set to Nietzsche's words.
When Zarathustra was 30 years old, he left his home and the lake of his home and went into the mountains. There he enjoyed his spirit and solitude, and for 10 years did not weary of it. But at last his heart changed. And rising one morning with the rosy dawn, he went before the sun and spoke to it thus. You, great star, what would your happiness be had you not those for whom you shine?
It was around the time of these early tone poems in the early 1890s that Strauss was courting his future wife, Pauline. Here's Brian Gilliam.
She was a singer, and he was, at first, her opera coach. And I guess these coaching sessions moved on to more romantic pleasures.
Under Strauss's coaching, Pauline became a very successful dramatic soprano, singing Wagner operas at Bayreuth while her husband conducted. On their wedding day, he presented her with four songs.
That was his Opus 27. That was his wedding present to his wife, which is, of course, contains maybe his most famous song, Morgen. When he orchestrated it, he had a solo violin, which, of course, represented his wife.
Strauss wrote more than 200 songs, most of them for the female voice, and many of them for Pauline. They often performed together, and critics agreed that her interpretation of her husband's songs was unmatched. But this picture is not as straightforward as it seems. Pauline was quite a complicated character. Back to Paul Thomason.
Pauline Strauss stories, they're just legion and legendary. She was from an aristocratic Bavarian family. Her father was a well-known Bavarian general. And Pauline loved to say that she had married beneath her, marrying this mere musician.
Despite this, Strauss was completely devoted to her. Leon Botstein.
She was overbearing, obnoxious, nobody seemed to have liked her.
She was not shy of telling anybody, even if they didn't ask, that her husband really was not a very good composer. And she would ask Strauss why he couldn't write nice tunes like Massenet did. There was a real composer.
She spoke her mind. She had no filter. She would just could say the most incredible things at a dinner, insult someone, interrupt someone, have a temper tantrum.
She had an opinion about everything, and she was absolutely right, even if she didn't know what she was talking about, and she was going to dominate, and Strauss put up with a lot of it.
And Strauss actually seemed to enjoy this in an odd way. He got a kick out of it.
She would let him have it. He said, I need this. I need to be brought down. I need to be cut down to size. And she was more than happy to do it.
It really was a marriage made in heaven in a weird way. And he said many times that he was a rather indolent person. He was really rather lazy. He'd rather just play cards and sit in the garden. She ruled that house like a Bavarian general's daughter. And she would say, compose, compose, compose. Come on, we need money, compose. And he often said he would not have composed nearly as much if it hadn't been for her.
Strauss was blessed. She was a devoted, ambitious general's daughter. She was a disciplinarian in terror. But she provided safety and stability and didn't get in his way as an artist and gave him the peace of mind to work. And for that, he was incredibly grateful because she ultimately was not psychically demanding on him. And that's a huge gift to an artist.
You're listening to Music is a Holy Art, a celebration of Richard Strauss from WQXR in New York. I'm soprano Debbie Voigt, and when we come back, we'll see how Strauss moved from the orchestral stage to the opera stage. Stay with us. Writing the tone poems, a profound shift took place in Strauss's musical output. He turned to opera. Here's Strauss scholar Brian Gilliam.
And if you look at a composer such as Verdi or Wagner, those are composers who started out in the theater from the very outset. They were men of the theater.
Strauss had spent much of his life composing instrumental works, as well as a lot of songs.
But as a young man, he loved to go to the theater.
Strauss had written two operas during the time of the tone poems, but neither had been a success. When he got to his third, he tried something different. He centered the whole thing on a female character.
Look at Wagner. You've got Siegfried, Lohengrin, Parsifal, Tannhäuser. These are all major male roles. Strauss absolutely reverses this trend by having all female roles.
And no other major opera composer would write as many operas centered on their female stars. Of Strauss's 15 operas, most of them are named after their female protagonists. This would become his trademark. It begins with a pair of iconic operas, Salome and Elektra.
With Salome and Elektra, Strauss brought in the 20th century, in my mind, just as much as Stravinsky with The Rite of Spring.
That's James Conlon, music director of the Los Angeles Opera. Salome premiered in 1905, Elektra in 1909, both well before The Rite of Spring in 1913. Strauss would boldly push the limits of orchestral sound further than anyone had ever heard before.
And then another radical step is the
brazen choice of subjects that shock. And this, of course, is the first time that there's an aesthetic of ugliness. And I mean an aesthetic of ugliness not just in sound, but of in behavior. I mean, of course, there have always been villains and bad people in operas, and it's made of that. But it goes to a new degree here. I mean, Zalame, the actions of Zalame go well beyond anything that had been normal, so to speak, in opera before that.
Zalame is the story of a Judean princess, a teenage girl, who becomes infatuated with the prophet Yohanan, John the Baptist. He rejects her totally. Zalame's stepfather, King Herod, then asks her to dance erotically for him, offering anything she wishes in exchange. And after she does a striptease for her stepfather, she asks for the head of John the Baptist on a silver platter, which she gets.
And it's an opera that's a very disturbing opera. It's anti-religious. It makes fun of Christianity. It makes fun of Judaism.
All of this was in the original play by Oscar Wilde, which Strauss used as his libretto.
But he's got incest, necrophilia. You choose the scandalous part and you will get it. Cutting someone's head off and kissing a decapitated head. What could be more disgusting than that?
Strauss fully intended to shock.
Oh, he understood the appeal of sensationalism, no doubt about it.
That's music writer Paul Thomason, who's written extensively on Strauss.
It was a success. It was also extremely scandalous, of course. Not only because of the subject matter and the fact that the music very clearly conveys all the neurotic eroticism of this severed head and this teenage girl who's gone nuts, but also some of the dissonance in the music. And it was a huge orchestra.
One of the most shocking places is the very end of the opera. Zalame is kissing the severed head of John the Baptist.
When she says, "I've kissed your mouth," there's almost an orgasm over just the way Dina moved. It's really pretty, pretty shocking.
After Zalame, Strauss wanted to do a comedy, something totally different. But then he came across a play and a playwright that made him reconsider. After Zalame, Strauss wrote Elektra.
Zalame dazzles, Elektra overwhelms. It is Elektra's hatred from beginning to end.
Elektra really wants to avenge the murder of her father, Agamemnon. The murder was committed by her mother, Clytemnestra, and her mother's lover. And Elektra is obsessed with the idea of avenging her father's death. That's her only reason for living.
Similar to Zalame, Elektra was successful, but also very shocking.
So it's an opera that's really about obsession and revenge and the price that puts on a person and how consuming that will be. And it seemed at the time to be such dissonance. Strauss expresses in the orchestra some of the brutal emotions very vividly.
This was the first opera that Strauss wrote with Hugo von Hofmannsthal, launching a creative partnership that would last until 1929 and produce many of Strauss's most successful operas. Strauss had seen a production of Hofmannsthal's play Elektra and then worked with him to adapt the text for the opera.
And that's how it all started, because Hofmannsthal did a very good job and was cooperative.
The original story of Elektra comes from ancient Greece, but Hofmannsthal gives it a distinctly modern reading. He was living in Vienna in the early 1900s and was well aware of Freud's groundbreaking experiments.
I think Hofmannsthal is doing, to a certain extent, what Freud tried to do, explain through mythology a common language in Western Europe to explain deeper psychological insights.
Most of this opera is populated by women, but there is one significant male role, that of Orest, Elektra's brother. He shows up in the middle of the drama.
And she shrieks his name, Orest. And the orchestra then vividly depicts her mind totally disintegrating. It just goes right out of any sense of tonality. And then within a moment or so comes back and there's this wonderful caressing lullaby melody, as if she's reverted to being an infant again.
Ultimately, it's Orest who commits the murder Elektra has been longing for.
It's a very deeply cathartic opera at the end. Strauss is not just, he's not a voyeur. He's letting us feel how fulfilled Elektra is at the end.
After Zalame and Elektra, such heavy music and subject matter, Strauss decided it was time to change gears. It was time for a romantic comedy. Der Rosenkavalier, or The Knight of the Rose, is Strauss's most famous opera. The knight is a male character, but he is sung by a mezzo-soprano. For Strauss, even his best male characters must be women. Here's the plot.
Young aristocrat named Octavian grows up from being the young lover of the Marschallin, who's older than him, to finding the woman for him, whom he can rescue and who will then look up to him.
Like the tone poem Don Juan, we start with a very sexually explicit musical depiction. Octavian is making love to the Marschallin before the curtain rises. The audience only hears the music.
There's no doubt in the orchestra whatsoever what's going on and who is doing what to whom. And the horns are Octavian.
Hofmannsthal throws together many elements to create this story. He mixes French comedy with Italian comedy, but sets it in Vienna during the 18th century reign of the Habsburg Empress Maria Theresa. Back to Brian Gilliam.
And it's a wonderful amalgam of sources for Hofmannsthal, but it's also a wonderful amalgam of types and styles of music.
You have music that sounds like Mozart. You have music that sounds like Verdi. You have music that sounds like Johann Strauss, the great waltz king, and no relation to Richard Strauss. And, of course, the overflowing chromatic music of Richard Strauss himself. In the middle of all this, there is a love triangle, which allows Strauss and Hofmannsthal to examine relationships from several different points of view.
Well, it has to do with what is love, what are the stages of love, how does one cope with the passage of time and the fact that life is constantly something new that we have to adapt to and yet be ourselves.
Strauss and Hofmannsthal modeled Octavian on another male character sung by a woman, the beloved Cherubino from Mozart's Marriage of Figaro. Octavian's most famous scene is in the middle of Act II, when he presents young Sophie with a silver rose from her suitor, Baron Ox. And Strauss, ever the visual composer, depicts silver in music.
He does it by the use of flutes, harps, and celeste, and they're playing in a different key to the rest of the orchestra, so you have this polytonality. Silver really is striking. It stands out. It's bright.
Listen closely, and you can hear the sound of silver sparkling in the orchestra. During this glorious presentation, Octavian realizes he himself is attracted to Sophie. They sing a duet, which is exactly the vocal sound that has come to be known as Straussian. For the final scene of Der Rosenkavalier, Hofmannsthal thought the plot had lost momentum. It was going to be boring.
Strauss said, "You're going to have to trust me on this one. I think I know what I'm doing. I think you'll like it."
The opera ends with a magnificent trio, a high point of the opera and the most famous music of Strauss's operatic output. Strauss and Hofmannsthal continued working together for the better part of two decades, writing the operas Ariadne auf Naxos, The Woman Without a Shadow, and The Egyptian Helen. While some of these are in the repertoire today, they weren't the immediate success Rosenkavalier had been. The next time Strauss and Hofmannsthal would have a bona fide hit was with Arabella. Hofmannsthal rated some of his earlier works for different elements of the story.
Arabella has to make a good marriage to save her family from bankruptcy. So it's how does she, on the one hand, do what she needs to do as a good girl, but wait for the right guy.
Strauss and Hofmannsthal set out to create a kind of Rosenkavalier Part II, and certainly the duet Arabella has with her sister brings back memories of Octavian and Sophie in Rosenkavalier. In addition to the music, there are other similarities to Rosenkavalier.
We again have Vienna. We again have somebody looking to get married. But he wrote a really wonderful part for a bass baritone in the role of Mandrika.
Sadly, Arabella would be the final opera Strauss and Hofmannsthal would write. This would be the last time the two great artists would soar together. Strauss and Hofmannsthal were working on the libretto. They had rough drafts of all three acts and had just finished the final version of Act One. Strauss sent Hofmannsthal a telegram saying, "Congratulations, I just received the finished Act One. It's perfect. I'm going to start composing." Here's Brian Gilliam.
And it arrived the day that Hofmannsthal died. And even worse, Hofmannsthal's son had died 2 days earlier. He was on his way to his son's funeral he was getting dressed for the funeral, he said to his wife, "I feel a little tired." He sat down in a chair and collapsed.
Hofmannsthal died of grief. Strauss was shattered.
He thought he'd never compose again. But when Strauss faced a crisis, he always worked his way out of it by composing.
In honor of Hofmannsthal, Strauss would set Acts 2 and 3 exactly as Hofmannsthal had written them, rather than making any revisions he certainly would have made if Hofmannsthal had still been alive. Arabella would be a tribute to his great collaborator of more than 20 years. You're listening to Music is a Holy Art, a celebration of Richard Strauss from WQXR in New York. I'm soprano Debbie Voigt, and when we come back, we'll take a look at the most controversial part of Strauss's life. Stay with us. After the death of Hugo von Hofmannsthal in 1929, Strauss began looking for another librettist, and he found writer Stefan Zweig. Here's music writer Paul Thomason.
Strauss was amazed that he got along so well with Zweig, and he thought, oh, well, here's... I'm just so incredibly lucky after all these operas with Hofmannsthal to find this other librettist. It wasn't the same, but it was equally enthusiastic, and Strauss loved working with him.
They wrote one opera together, The Silent Woman, based on the play by Ben Jonson.
It's an opera. It's music about a man who doesn't like music. That's the premise. It's hilarious in that sense. So here's a composer making jokes about music.
When Adolf Hitler came to power in 1933, Strauss entered the most controversial period of his life. The Nazis asked him to become the president of their newly formed Reich Music Chamber, an institution meant to promote Aryan music and censor what it called degenerate music. He accepted the position. More from Leon Botstein.
He really didn't take all the anti-Semitism too seriously. He wildly underestimated how bad these people were. And he ended up thinking, these are going to be good patrons. A lot of music is going to be done. He's going to get a lot of, you know, royalties. They're going to put out of business all these fake charlatans who are modernists. And he's going to control the policy, the cultural policy in music, his way.
It was during this time that Strauss finished The Silent Woman with Stefan Zweig.
It was a success at the premiere, but the Nazis banned it after the third or fourth performance because Stefan Zweig was Jewish.
And Strauss was already causing trouble for the Nazis because he refused to sign documents banning compositions by Jewish composers. He also insisted that Zweig's name be on the poster for The Silent Woman, against the Nazis' wishes.
He was pretty naive about all that stuff. He wanted to keep working with Zweig. And Zweig said, well, we can't. I mean, I'm getting ready to leave Germany. We can't. And Strauss says, oh, who cares? This gang of hoodlums will be gone in a few years, and we'll just put everything in the drawer until then.
In their correspondence, Strauss became frustrated that Zweig wouldn't go along with his plan. Why couldn't they just keep working together secretly until the Nazis were gone? Here's a famous letter he wrote to Zweig.
Your letter drives me to despair. This Jewish obstinacy. It drives one to anti-Semitism. This racial pride, this feeling of solidarity, even I feel a difference. Do you imagine I have ever been led in the course of a single action by the thought that I am Germanic? Do you suppose Mozart was consciously Aryan in his composing? For me, there are only two sorts of people, those who have talent and those who haven't. And for me, the people only begin to exist when they become the audience. It's the same to me if they come from China, Upper Bavaria, New Zealand, or Berlin, so long as they have paid full price at the box office.
Strauss goes on to say that he doesn't take the presidency of the Reich Music Chamber seriously. He only does it to keep things from getting worse, and that he would take on this type of irritating position no matter which political party was in charge.
And that letter castigating the Nazis was opened by the Gestapo. And Strauss was stripped of all of his honors and became persona non grata.
Even though it was brief, Strauss's association with the Nazis will always be a stain on his biography. And there is still discussion about why he accepted the position in the first place.
I don't think there is any artist who is not stung by criticism. So Strauss's misbehavior, which is the kindest thing you can say about it, when Hitler comes to power, the reasons for it have, I think, a lot to do with the resentment that piled up during the Weimar period in the way he was viewed, treated, and ignored by young critics, accused of note spinning, repeating himself, and the big rage for what he considered to be a mixture of charlatanism and stupidity.
In his early career, Strauss's music had been scandalous and controversial, but after the First World War, his music was not taken as seriously.
As Strauss got older, the issue wasn't scandal, was dismissiveness. And that must have gotten to him. He made the wrong bet. He bet with what he thought would be patrons, whom he looked down upon. He fell out with the Nazis and got frightened, finally. But he fell out with the Nazis because of just unmitigated arrogance on his part.
Strauss was fired by the Nazis in 1935, and he spent most of his time after that in Vienna, feeling safer there than in Munich or Berlin. No longer able to work with Stefan Zweig, he began writing operas with Joseph Gregor, the first of which was Friedenstag, or Peace Day, a pacifist opera. This opera, too, proved problematic. Strauss scholar Brian Gilliam.
It had to pass the Nazi censors. And here is Germany at the brink of war and a pacifist opera. Once they declared war, it was not allowed to be produced.
During the war, Strauss began writing works harkening back to a much earlier time. It starts with his second horn concerto, written in 1942.
Strauss, quite frankly, became nostalgic as the war went on. And this horn concerto is a quite different work. Here's a composer who has written all of these operas, all of these tone poems in between, and it is a thing of sonic beauty.
Strauss was terribly worried about his family all through the war. His son had married a Jewish woman, Elise, and they had two children together. On several occasions, the Gestapo arrested Elise and attempted to send her off to a concentration camp. Strauss was able to pull some strings and save her, but there were some very close calls. Strauss also went to one of the concentration camps to try to rescue some of Elise's extended family. He was not successful.
So as Strauss is being more and more clouded by the realities of war, his struggles with his Jewish daughter-in-law and Jewish grandsons, the worries about this and that, he becomes nostalgic about his youth. He writes Wind Serenades again. He starts writing in classic forms. He writes an oboe concerto.
After the war was over, towards the end of his life, Strauss was a profoundly unhappy man. Germany was in ruins, and all of his beloved opera houses had been destroyed. He wrote the Metamorphosen for 23 solo strings, his bleakest work, and a final grand example of musical transformation.
The idea would be, normally in a metamorphosis or transfiguration, a human would attain a higher position, a higher level. But, and this is really about a very negative work, a work where the metamorphosis goes from the human to the bestial. That German culture went from the lofty realm of Goethe, of Schiller, of Beethoven, to the world of Nazi domination. And a whole nation complicit in one way or another. And so he takes this inner look at himself and at a nation and a culture, and how could this happen?
The four last songs for soprano and orchestra are the final pieces Strauss wrote, and some of his most beloved. Brian Gilliam.
What is fascinating, however, is that in the four last songs, when we have Im Abendrot at sunset, he quotes Death and Transfiguration at the end.
We hear the famous theme of the ideal.
And I've known the Strauss family since 1979, and his daughter-in-law, Alice, told me, you know, she sat at his deathbed. She was his nurse. He never had a daughter. His daughter-in-law was really the daughter he didn't have. She nursed him and sat by his bedside. And in fact, I read all her notes. She took notes of every day what he was saying while he was having his feverish states, and when he was lucid, she'd write stuff down. But she told me at lunch, I remember, she said, you know, he told me on his deathbed, he said, little did I know that how right I had it back when I was in my 20s. It's just like as I imagined it.
Just like he imagined it in Death and Transfiguration. Strauss spent the last year of his life at his home in Garmisch, where he died on September 8, 1949. It was in the afternoon.
Strauss, the man, has been profoundly misunderstood. He was, of composers in the 19th and 20th century tradition, probably the most intellectually sophisticated and probably the smartest in the sense of the acuteness of his understanding of the modern condition. He also understood, more than most composers, that music was, in a way, a realistic art. It was not an art of fanciful dreaming. Was not a metaphysical art. So, like Mozart, he's the only other composer who really is able to translate into music the ambiguities of human life, of the unhappinesses that are in marriage, the pain that comes from love, the inevitability of loss that comes with desire.
So on a very deep level, Strauss is celebrating life itself in all of its different permutations, good, bad, indifferent, as it changes, which is one reason that I keep going back to Strauss so often. He's very, I would almost use the word cleansing. He's very uplifting, but in a very deep way.
If you'd like more information about the music we've used in this program, please go to our website, wqxr.org, for a complete list of pieces and performers. Music is a Holy Art was written and produced by Aaron Cohen. Our executive producer is Matt Abramovitz. Literary quotes within the program were read by James Lurie. Our engineers were Bill O'Neill, George Wellington, Roberto Toledo, and Rick Kwan. Special thanks to Jenny Hauser, Ryan Lohr, Elaine Warner, Kathleen Drowan, Aaron Dalton, Eileen Delahunty, Graham Parker, Yvette Bejel, Diane Taylor, Margaret Juntwaite, Will Berger, Jamie Katz, Richard Hake, the staff of the Metropolitan Opera and Carnegie Hall in New York, and the staff of Symphony Hall in Boston. This program is dedicated to Dr. M. Michael Cohen, Jr. I hope you've enjoyed our celebration of Richard Strauss. I'm Debbie Voigt, and you've been listening to a special presentation from WQXR in New York.